Welcome back to Dakota Midday. I'm Lori Walsh. One of the world's most treasured books is about to go on display in South Dakota. It's Shakespeare's first folio, and we're devoting this hour to the world of William Shakespeare and how that time in history impacts us today. I'm here with Dr. Darlene Farabee. She's chair of the English Department at the University of South Dakota and project director for the touring exhibit. Joining us now as well is Cleveland Johnson. He's director of the National Music Museum, where the historic 17th century volume will be on view. Cleveland Johnson, welcome to Dakota Midday.
Thanks very much. It's nice to be back.
So I'm going to start with the same question I asked Darlene at the top of the hour, which is, when did you first hear about the possibility of this coming and connect it with your museum?
Oh, I was a little bit farther down the chain of command. I heard about it from Darlene as she was beginning to assemble various allies and interested forces here in Vermilion to brainstorm a little bit about how we can make this happen.
Did it make sense to you right away that it would be a good fit for the National Music Museum, or did you sort of need to put some thought into how those two things would go together?
Oh, no, it was an instant go for me. It was the kind of project that university communities do so well, where you have the opportunity to take an idea, take a topic, and then pull in your entire community. And in this case, not only the university community, but also the town and as well as the museum here on campus.
So we mentioned earlier there's a lot of complicated sort of decisions that need to be made and some parameters that have to be in place in order to have the first folio come to your museum. What are some of those that you had to check off your list in order to qualify?
Well, the folio is a very important artifact, and it's taken great care of at the Folger Shakespeare Library in D.C. No museum lets its treasures out without very, very careful planning, and the folio is a good example of the job, the role that a museum plays in preserving our artifacts for posterity. So as they send something like this out on the road, and a very ambitious tour in this case, where they have an exhibit or location in every state, they're looking for facilities that can give the proper care and attention to the artifact that we can.
So give me an idea of what you have in the museum planned around from an exhibit standpoint. I understand you're tying some of your collection in with the first folio.
Well, it gives us an opportunity to build a little context for our visitors. We can tell a little bit about the world that Shakespeare lived in, the world that his plays were performed in. It gives us a chance to talk about the music culture of the time, because the musical instruments that we have in our collection, a good number of them date directly from this period. So we'll be presenting a number of very, very rare objects that will take you right back to the musical performances of Shakespeare time. Not only the performances that are going on in general out in the world that he knew, but the performances that were going on right on stage. Because as most of your listeners will know, Shakespeare's plays are just full of songs, full of lyrics. And in school, we usually see them only as text. But in performance, we know that they were, in fact, sung and played.
So, Darlene, I want to bring you back in here to the conversation for a minute. You literally wrote the book on staging Shakespeare. Give us an idea, technically, of how instruments and musicians or actors with instruments playing music would have been staged in an actual play of the time.
So, in a couple of instances where, for example, a young man is wooing a young woman, there are several scenes where we get instances of this, where he has hired musicians to walk on, sort of strolling players who come in with instruments and play music for his lady love. We also have instances where young people are being taught music. And so we have a musician who who will come in and maybe do some sort of a performance as a demonstration that this person is worthy to be an instructor for a young person, you know, sort of convincing the parent that this is a good teacher for them. Another instance is when we have nobility or royalty who have their own court musicians and the possibilities of calling on immediate entertainment. And so those are also instances where you have a musician who walks on stage with instrument to play for someone who can command. That's a command performance in every sense of it, right?
Did Shakespeare write music?
I don't think he actually wrote the music itself, right? But there's some doubt about whether or not he wrote the lyrics of particular songs. It's pretty certain that he probably did write some of the lyrics for some of the songs. But oftentimes, I think that a good bit of what was sung on stage was actually set to kind of standardized tunes.
Sure. So, Cleveland, tell us more about the music culture of the time.
Well, this is during the great reign of Queen Elizabeth I, and her court was lavishly musical. She kept on retainer dozens and dozens and dozens of professional musicians, so that we know that the musical culture at the court level was absolutely astounding. I mean, many of the great names of the day were under the employ of Queen Elizabeth, people like William Byrd and Thomas Tompkins, for example, who would write music of this time and in many cases set the text of Shakespeare's plays. But in the world at large, whether it was in the streets, whether it was in the military, whether it was in the church, this was a great blossoming in music history, and Shakespeare was surrounded by it.
What kind of instruments are you going to have on display in conjunction?
Well, the most exciting instrument that we're featuring for this, actually it's always on exhibit at the museum, but it's easily overlooked when you're doing your general walkthrough and looking at the other 1,100 instruments on public display. We're bringing downstairs a very, very rare instrument from this period, the only surviving English cittern in the world. An absolute unique object. The cittern is a very popular instrument during this time. It's a simple little flat-backed string instrument. Sounds a little bit like a banjo perhaps today because of its steel strings. And it was played in the streets. It was typically found hanging on the wall in the barbershop. So if you were there either getting your hair cut or your bloodlet, whatever was going on in those days in the barbershops, the cittern was there for you to strum on. And the only surviving English cittern from this period is going to be right there, about 12 feet away from the first folio.
So it would have been available to a person as they were getting their hair cut for them to play, not a musician to play.
Just
while
like you may have a magazine to read in the in the barbershop.
Would everybody have known how to do this? Was this something that everybody could pick up?
Yeah, the cittern is a fairly simple instrument to play. It's not a very highly developed skill.
It's kind of like
the guitar today. I mean, of course, there are great performers on the guitar, but if you pick it up, you can very quickly learn to strum a few chords as well. And the cittern was pretty much the equivalent.
What can you tell us about the security of the first folio? Is it here yet? Has it arrived? Do you know where it's at before it comes?
It arrives this week, it'll be installed this week. So the security extends not only to its physical security, like you and I might first think, and you know, do we have armed guards on hand, or does it show up in a Brinks truck like it's worth $1 million? There's that kind of security that's, of course, important to any museum, ours included. There's also security of its environment. Is it in an environment where it will remain undamaged and it will remain safe and sound? And that extends not only to temperature, to humidity, which has to be absolutely stable, but also to lighting levels. These are all elements that are monitored and measured and reported on daily.
Did you have to make changes to your museum, or was most of those parameters something that you were already doing because of the nature?
Well, that's one of the reasons that it's coming to the museum, because as Darlene was putting this all together, in fact, the first thing she had to check off her list was, is there a facility here on campus in Vermilion that that can provide this museum quality environment for the folio, which was the basic starting point for the whole idea. And so we're lucky to have the National Music Museum here on campus because we're good to go with that.
And now admission will be free for the entire museum during the time the folio was here?
Yes.
So that's sort of, if you haven't ever been to that museum yet.
That's a nice bonus. Generally, only Fridays are free.
Yeah.
Throughout the period of the folio's visit with us, the entire period is free.
And once you come, you're going to want to come back when it's...
We hope so.
Yes, Darlene, tell us a little bit about Shakespeare in South Dakota and some interesting tidbits that might relate Shakespeare to our state.
Great. So it turns out one of the things I got really interested in was putting together this symposium that will be on the 18th and 19th of March. And in the evening on the 18th will be the fabulous Earhart concert. So you can go and hear the talks from the symposium and then go to the concert and do all of these things sort of over that weekend. And putting this together, I found out that there was and sort of looked into it. And we have a rich history of Shakespeare in South Dakota with everything from Shakespeare reading clubs that were established in the 19th century to a quite rich and vibrant history in the 19th century South Dakota newspapers of using Shakespeare's plays as parts of their advertisements and their advertising campaigns. So there's lots of that, and there's also sort of contemporary South Dakota Shakespeare. We do have a South Dakota Shakespeare Festival here in South Dakota, and we also have there are several other ties to kind of interesting things in the state, right? Like the Yankton College Outdoor Theater, which is now closed to the public, of course, but was a purpose-built outdoor theater for Shakespeare plays, and it was the first one of these in the nation. So there were articles about this in Architectural Digest and things like that in the early 20th century when it was first built. So
let's talk a little bit about kids or families as they interact with this. What Cleveland sort of things are you doing to sort of bring people of all ages into the exhibit so that they can interact with it in a way that makes sense to younger viewers?
Well, the exhibit is very accessible, I think, to any age group, except perhaps for our youngest visitors. But, it's a question of how parents help their children understand what they're seeing. The panels that are going to be a part of the exhibit pull out some of the famous quotes from the folio, and I think there's a wonderful chance there for people of any age to have an aha moment when they say, oh, that's Shakespeare. These things that you hear so frequently. We're really happy to have a facsimile of the folio, as Darlene mentioned earlier in the hour, so that although you can only look at the original folio behind glass, you can actually go and leaf through the facsimile and get a sense of what the book was like. And see it laid out from page to page, from opening to opening. The folio, correct me, the folio is going to be open to what quote, do you know?
It'll be open to Hamlet's To Be or Not to Be speech.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
And who decided that? Did you get to choose?
The Folger Shakespeare Library decided that, and I think that decision was based on the fact that this is probably the most quoted line from English literature.
Sure. Right. Is it the same for every state?
Yes.
Or do they have to change it for the book itself?
No, it's the same.
It's the same.
Every location. So. But our facsimile will allow you to leaf through, and you can pull out, you can go looking for all of your favorite Shakespeare quotes.
So you'll be there when it gets installed. And
yes.
What's your role during installation day?
Well, the folio arrives with a courier, and the courier will work with our team to install it over a period of 3 days. Mm-hmm. This entire week is very exciting. Just this morning, we're finishing the installation of our own objects, the cittern, as I mentioned, and any number of other instruments. Getting ready for that. All the chairs in our concert hall are being removed because our concert hall is basically being changed from a concert hall into this special exhibit gallery throughout the month. So the chairs are leaving probably as we speak, and we'll be all ready for the folio to arrive. And then it's a matter of setting up the case, making sure that all the climate and lighting parameters are correct, setting up the panels and positioning them in the room, make sure we're happy with everything.
Do you get nervous?
No.
Vasa, no. You're a pro. You're not, this doesn't give
this
you any anxiety
no.
at all, right? So
no,
that's why it's in your hands and not mine, because I'm getting nervous thinking about unpacking this and making sure nothing goes wrong.
But you have to understand at the National Music Museum, we have so many rare, priceless treasures ourselves that we deal with every day. And so it's perfectly normal when you live in a building with four Stradivari instruments and rare Italian violins and the only English Saturn on the planet, we kind of take it in stride.
It's in good hands. Darlene, what should parents tell their kids when they come? What kind of conversation? Cleveland mentioned having that conversation. Or what does a high school teacher tell her or his students when they come down? How do you put this in perspective before you walk in the door?
Sure. I think that the great thing is, well, first of all, it's exciting to see something that is an artifact from 1623.
Right.
Just the sort of sheer fact that this is
how
almost 400 years.
How often do you see something
right?
old? Yeah.
So there's that, right? I mean, there is a historical artifact aspect to it. It's also a really lovely reminder of how books themselves were made. We're so accustomed to being able to hit print. And the sort of realization, and it is physically apparent when you look at the book, that this is impressed, it's printed into the paper. And so, you know, sort of emphasizing, I think for parents probably not simply that this is a Shakespeare book, but that these are artifacts that are part of our cultural history. And this is, you know, the case for the musical instruments from the period, for the book itself. That to be able to sort of experience these objects in person is a rich moment.
You've been listening to Darlene Farabee and Cleveland Johnson. Cleveland Johnson is director of the National Music Museum, which owns and exhibits some of the most historically significant musical instruments in existence. Dr. Farabee is chair of the English Department at USD. First Folio, the book that gave us Shakespeare, will be on view at the National Music Museum from March 7th to April 2nd. During that time, a series of events and lectures and concerts will also be going on. Admission to the National Music Museum during the 27 days of the First Folio exhibit at USD will be free. We'll put links to the complete event schedule on our website. Our website is sdpb.org/Dakota Midday. Sorry about that. And you can also try www.usd.edu/Shakespeare. Thank you, Dr. Farabee, for coming in today and spending time with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And thank you, Cleveland Johnson.
Thank you.
It has
a
been a pleasure. When we come back, the music that surrounded Shakespeare, Grammy-nominated lutenist Ron McFarlane plays for us after the break. You're listening to Dakota Midday, SDPB Radio.